So now that there's a coronavirus vaccine,
yeah,
I feel like I'm not going to be safe getting it unless I personally like watch Dr. Anthony Fauci get that vaccine.
Well, you can bet a good amount of money that that will be, when that happens, if that happens, it's going to be broadcast on CNN. It's going to be a primetime event. And it'll be like
primetime event for Fauci getting the vaccine. They're going to have like 8 different camera angles.
It'll be at like 8 p.m. Wolf Blitzer will be on. It's like, we're going live right now. Stand by to see Dr. Fauci get the coronavirus vaccine. And he's like very TV savvy now. He's a very TV savvy guy and he knows how to talk his way through things. So it's going to be like him. It's like, I'm here reporting live from the Mount Zion Hospital and like the West Upper West Side, where I'm on the desk to get the coronavirus vaccine, and he'll like walk you through it. And
the background music is just like the How It's Made music playing over and over again.
Yeah, just imagine that. And they roll up his sleeve and it's like, they're rolling up my sleeve and the nurse.
This is a key virus alert.
Dun, 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 dun. From late June to early August, we took a 14,000-mile cross-country road trip to get away from the world.
It brought us to 20 national parks, 33 states, 46 cities, and 43 national monuments, forests, memorials, grasslands, and recreation areas.
So in each episode, we'll outline one of our stops, talk about the history of the place, our impressions, and a piece of dark history tea associated with it.
It's gonna be dramatic, scandalous, dare I say captivatingly funny, and hopefully it inspires your next trip in the United States.
This is Road Boys with Jeremy
and Jacob. Welcome to another episode.
Hit me with it.
Of Road Boys.
Of Road Boys. We're at episode 10. We're on the next Star Wars trilogy. It's not yet named.
The one that's not made yet.
The one that's coming out in like 10 years when people really want one.
Jesus. Wow. Mm-hmm. This has been such a journey. And we're finally, I think, at a point where I'm really excited about where we are.
I've been excited since we hit Virginia. When we left the state of Maryland. I don't know about you.
Well, I was excited, but I'm more excited to be out west, like talking about all the cool shit out there.
Yes, we've hit a point in the journey of our road trip where everything was sort of unbelievable. We can't believe our eyes. We've really left our home green area.
Yes, and now as we're recording this, we're heading into the week of Thanksgiving, very exciting yes. stuff. But what's more significant about the week of Thanksgiving, Jeremy, mm-hmm. is that it comes 2 weeks before my birthday, which, you know, is a mass media event.
It is. And they're telling everyone not to travel for Jacob's birthday. Don't go out.
Yes.
It's a whole thing.
So. I know, because it's just going to be such a celebration. Mm-hmm. Am I going to get an Instagram post this year?
Yeah, you always get Instagram posts.
I've never gotten one, so I'm very excited if this is a new development here.
Well, we're going to make sure on my end at this department, it's a fantastic birthday for you.
Yes, maybe, you're coming to my house.
Maybe I'll see you in person. Who knows? Maybe we'll do an episode together in person. Who knows?
Wow. So many exciting things there. You know, what was your best birthday party?
My best birthday party? Oh, don't get me started about my best birthday
Wait,
party.
I know you so well, and I figure you must have had some, like, pretty awesome ones.
Well, you're definitely setting me up for maybe one of the best moments of my childhood to talk about it at least. So my best birthday party, if you're asking, was when I turned 9. That would have been the year sometime in the 2000s. I don't want to give away my age. Yeah, I can never reveal my age, but I turned 9 and
he's 68.
And don't look it up, but, you know, think around in the 2000s is when the year was the, there was a year when Pixar released the classic film Ratatouille, maybe the best Pixar film of all time, Ratatouille. And that's disputed. But in my mind, I wanted to be a chef. And I really was into the fact that maybe the, I could see a movie where an unlikely creature could be a chef. So I invited like 10 of my friends to go to the movies and see this this masterpiece. And then afterwards, of course, we had lunch at a barbecue place. I wish it was French, but it was a barbecue place. And the giveaway, Jacob, the giveaway was Rachel Ray cookbooks, kids cookbooks.
Oh, my God. You gave away Rachel Ray cookbooks at a birthday party?
You bet your ass.
Wait, but this
you did.
This was not your decision, was it?
No, it was probably and 100%, not even probably, my mother's. And I watched a lot of the Food Network. So when she said, here's this idea, we can get them like from Costco, we can get like a stockpile of them. I was like, yeah, I think people would love that. And I think to this day, if you were invited to that party, you were treated to a good time and a great giveaway. I'm just saying.
Well, I think you're correct about that. So your mother really wanted you to be gay.
Yeah, she really she really wanted me to be gay.
I mean, giving away Rachel Ray cookbooks, I'm like, yes, bitch. Like, I'm so here for that.
And believe me, I wish you were invited. You would have had an amazing time. And maybe you'd agree with me after seeing it in that setting that Ratatouille is the best Pixar movie they ever made.
No, I'll never see it that way.
Mm-hmm. Well, that was my best. Can you compete with yours, potentially, your birthday?
No, I can't.
Well,
my life has been full of disappointments. But anyway, that leads me directly into what we have to do today, because I know, Jeremy, that this is going to be a long one, because what I have found for this week's Dark History is going to be absolutely insane. So make sure you stay tuned for that.
Yes.
And we might as well get into the episode and talk about where we're going to be this week.
Yeah.
In the last episode, where were we?
We were in Colorado, southern portion, southwestern, Mesa Verde National Park.
Oh, that's right. Mesa Verde and Durango.
In Durango.
And this week, we traveled a little more westward, and we pooled our resources to make it out to the great city of Moab.
Ooh. Now, where is Moab? Where the hell is it? What is it? Tell me about it.
It's on Mars.
Basically.
It basically is. It's in Utah. It's in eastern Utah. And I'll tell you all about Moab as we start our Moab history lesson.
Okay. Tell me, why should I care about Moab?
Well, you should care about Moab because it's a biblical name that actually referred to the land on the eastern side of the Jordan River in Africa. Mm-hmm. But the town in Utah was named because the first postmaster there believed the biblical land and this land were the far out country. obviously refers to the geographical landscape.
The outer lands. Now, Jacob, you started this history, and I felt like I was back in my my 12th grade Bible class in high school, 2015, 2016.
Oh, that's right. You went to a brainwash school.
That is too recent, but those years. But I felt like I was in that class. But go on. Tell me more about this history.
Yeah, well, from 1829 to the early 1850s, Moab served as the Colorado River crossing along the old Spanish Trail.
So people be walking.
Bitches be walking. In April of 1855, the Latter-day Saint settlers attempted to establish a trading fort on the land, but since they were straight white men stealing land from what was shockingly originally Native Navajo settlements, Native Americans fought back and forced them to abandon the project.
Well, they're Mormons and they were going to have to fight. I don't know about that.
That usually doesn't go well.
It ends in them losing. I don't know. I don't want to badmouth Mormons. Maybe you have a big Mormon following.
We do. That. They really love us in Ireland. So, you know.
Ireland.
Yeah, that's where a lot of our downloads come from. I've been looking at that.
That's true. We have a big Irish following. We got
some Irish listeners. Yeah. How do I do an Irish? Top of the morning to ya.
Well, I think you have to have the gene. And if you don't have the gene, you can't do an accent.
Now, that's not what I heard.
See, I don't think you don't have the gene.
Hey, rude. Okay, mm-hmm. Well, anyway, back to Moab. In 1878, a new group of settlers from Rich County established permanent setup, and Moab officially became a town in 1902.
Ooh, okay.
So that's when it became a town.
Yes.
But in 1883, the Denver and Rio Grande Western Railroad main line was constructed across Utah. But just like Santa Fe, Jeremy, they skipped over Moab, and it soon became irrelevant despite being one of the few natural crossings over the Colorado River.
Oh, that line just keeps popping up, I feel like. And maybe if it hit it, Moab would be a huge city. Who knows?
Are you telling me that the industry in this country was built on railroads?
Yes.
I think that's exactly what it was.
You're telling me that exactly.
So Moab's economy was originally agriculture-based, but in the 1910s, uranium, potash, and manganese were discovered in the area.
Well, that sounds both expensive and very poisonous, all three of those. I don't know exactly what potash is, but you know.
I would agree. It's one of those element things. But oil and gas were found in the 1920s, so Moab became a mining town very quickly.
Yes.
This brings us all the way to World War II, when a former Civilian Conservation Corps camp, now we're talking about the CCC, got that FDR New Deal a realness.
It's the triple C.
The triple C. When you want the real deal. You better go triple C.
You better call triple C.
But anyway, the triple C. Oh, this gets really dark. That was a moment of levity.
I'm laughing. I'm having a great time.
That was a moment of levity before I tell you that this CCC camp outside Moab was used to confine Japanese American internees. Again, similar to the Santa Fe camp we talked about in episode 7, but on a much smaller scale.
Well, you set me up for, you dashed my hopes and dreams. That's depressing.
Yeah. It really took a turn there.
Mm-hmm.
But the camp was disbanded by 1946 and is now on the National Register of Historic Places.
Just like Four Seasons Total Landscaping. You got to sign the petition. It'll get on there.
Oh, I'm excited. You know what? I want to do an ad for Four Seasons Total Landscaping because they're now officially gay icons.
Yes, they are. Go ahead.
Four Seasons Total Landscaping. Go on. Get you some.
Every time, Jacob.
Thank you so much. I really added some flair.
Some real deal. I can't roll my R's. Every week I come to terms with the fact that I can't roll my R's, and it's really painful.
It's only because I'm better than you in every possible way.
What am I getting at? Of course. That's it.
Love you. But remember what I said about uranium? We're going back to Moab now.
Yeah.
What I said about uranium? Well, she's back again.
Ooh.
That's right. In the 1950s, geologist Charles Steen called Moab the uranium capital of the world after finding a rich deposit of the element south of the city.
Ooh, you got to line your pockets with uranium, and then maybe the leg will shrivel up and you'll die in it within a year, but I don't know.
I mean, imagine if the uranium was the world's economy.
Mm-hmm.
Moab would be the center. It would be New York. It would be Los Angeles.
It would be Los Angeles. It would be New York. It'd be all that and more. And yet,
yes.
And yet.
And yet it's Moab. So that discovery of uranium coincided with the era of nuclear weapons and nuclear power, which actually began Moab's boom years.
What constitutes having boom years in Moab?
Well, I'll tell you. The city's population grew nearly 500% over the next few years, bringing it to 6,000 people.
So it had no people there, and they got and they got 6,000 to come.
Essentially, yes. And Charles Steen, that geologist we were just talking about, donated a great deal of money and land to create new houses, churches, and schools to bring workers in to mine the uranium. So he's kind of building the town.
Yeah, well, that's good. He has a lot of people there now. He has a big city.
Yeah, 6,000. In the 1970s and 80s, as the Cold War progressed, Moab's uranium boom came to a close and the population declined.
Aww.
Yeah, you know how it be.
No.
It is worth mentioning that in 1949, Western film director John Ford used the same area, the area around Moab, for Wagon Master, his film. And since then, Moab and its surrounding area have been used in such films like Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, Thelma and Louise, Mission Impossible 2, and Star Trek. I mean, what a list we are talking about here. Realness.
It's a big list. And I swear when we were driving through it, I recognized spots. Like, that's that desert scene in like those 50 movies I saw, that sort of place.
Yeah, and we'll get to this, I think, in next week's episode, but Westworld is right around Moab, too.
Yeah, just a bit up the road.
Yeah, but to bring it to the modern day, Moab's economy has largely become dependent on tourism from visitors like us, Jeremy, who use it as the gateway town to Arches National Park and Canyonlands National Park. Again, next week's episode preview.
It's a double gateway town. This is a first for us, and maybe the only double gateway town we really saw.
I think you're right. It definitely was the only one where like two national parks are very close together,
right?
Except actually once in California, but we'll get there.
Oh yeah, we're gonna get there. We can't give away any spoilers, but cool town. It's a cool town.
Yeah, I do also want to mention that since 2011, Moab has hosted a significant LGBT Pride Festival every year. And by significant, I mean it made it onto their Wikipedia page.
And nationally recognized and historic LGBT Pride Parade.
I think they said by like 2013, there were 500 people in attendance, which is huge.
It's the hub of southeastern Utah.
what are you talking about southeastern Utah? Okay.
What do you mean?
Moab is the Paris.
Moab is the Paris. It's the Tokyo. It's New York. It's all the cities that Pitbull would speak about.
Did you get my Office reference there?
No.
Remember when he called Scranton the Paris of northeastern Pennsylvania?
I don't remember that specifically, but...
Well, Moab is the Paris of southeastern Utah.
Yes.
Yes, bitch. And that is the history of Moab. Not much has gone on there.
Not much has gone on there, but my God, it's such a beautiful, insane-looking place.
Would you call it the real deal?
Of whatever it is. It's the real deal of I've never seen a town like that. And
yeah.
Well, maybe we should just get into the fact that we drove from, so of course last week was Mesa Verde. We had another like maybe 4 hours or so, I forget specifically, on our drive to get to Moab from there. And the landscape changed dramatically from the time we were at Mesa Verde, which are these these like gradually inclining plateaus with big drops, and then kind of green. But then, of course, we got into like wheat fields and yellows, and you saw mountains, and all of a sudden, all that went away. We went into Utah, and the land just became, of course, more and more deserty. And to see that happen is sort of something in my mind. To see that happen naturally. It's very interesting.
It was the coolest thing. I did feel like we entered a different planet. on that drive-in. It was like nothing I think we had seen even before. And we had just come from the desert in New Mexico and through Colorado.
Right.
And yet this was still dramatically different.
Right, because everything starts fading away and the ground literally becomes red. And then you start seeing rock formations. And it's just another, I can't stress this enough. I'll say this about a lot of different places we visited, but it's otherworldly driving, like, you know, driving and seeing that sort of take place as you go along.
You know what I recommend? I think if you're listening, you should absolutely go on Google Maps and look at the overhead view of Moab. Because it's crazy.
And then if you have more time, you have nothing to do, maybe drive on some, maybe do the street view on some of those, on that highway going north into the town. It's crazy. It feels like you're literally like the Mars rover. You are the Mars rover.
We're the wild rover.
Mm-hmm.
but what I did love was camping in Moab. That was super special.
Yes.
That was like, we had this wall of red rock behind us, and we were just in our tent, and it was 105 degrees.
Right, during the day, thankfully, it got a little bit cooler overnight. That's probably the peak season for hotness.
Yeah, it was very hot during the day.
It has to be late June, early July. That's when we were there.
But the reason is because Moab is like kind of in a valley. So it's like the bottom where all the heat is.
Right. The heat collects. It gangs up on you down there.
Yeah. The second you start driving outside of Moab, it just gets like you start going up essentially in elevation.
Right. And yes. I was going to say that you did mention this, but the city is encased basically by a big red canyon, which I think just adds to how weird and how cool the city is. You can't look anywhere and not see like a wall of red rock surrounding the city.
Oh, absolutely. And we went to this food festival thing there. What was that?
It was a food truck rally. Rally of foods.
It was a rally.
They call it rallies. I'm just saying, if you're a hipster and you're into that sort of thing, they're called food truck rallies.
Yeah, well, I thought we got some pretty good food there, actually. And I liked that they had all these fans set up with mist. You know, I love a good mistin'.
Me too. But yes, we had a great time in Moab. And honestly, one of the more memorable gateway towns, I'd say, out there. And it's worth it, you know, just even just, I know that the parks are right there, but spend some time in that place because it's a really cool sort of, I think they're even building it up, sort of touristy place, but it has some real charm to it. It's unique.
Do you remember the showers we had at the campground?
Yeah, I do remember the shower we had at the campground.
The barrier at the top was like so low that we could see each other.
Yes. But those showers are so needed. We were, it was 100 something degrees.
Yes.
I would have paid $50.
You know what I liked on our trip a lot?
Mm.
We had some great shower conversations.
Mm-hmm.
Like while we were showering, we would converse.
We would converse about all sorts of things.
Like the meaning of life.
Probably.
I can't think of what else.
But we had some interesting topics. I trust and I know that we had some interesting conversations.
Oh, yeah. Like we talked about things like whether Rudy Giuliani uses hair dye.
He does. That was that was a real discussion we had back in the summer.
That's right.
Jacob said, do you think he uses hair dye? I was like, well, I don't know. Maybe if we see it start to drip in a press conference post-election, we'll know. And then
I think I distinctly remember saying that Rudy Giuliani, the face of 9/11, uses hair dye.
And I was like, I'm skeptical, but maybe there'll be a press conference held at the post-election after Trump loses and it'll start dripping off his face.
Can you believe we had that conversation in July?
We just are more politically in tune than a lot of people. So it makes sense to me.
It's our high status and culture.
Mm-hmm. So it makes no surprise. None of this is surprising to any of us, to either of us.
No, absolutely not. But
stuff like that we talk about, And we had yeah.
So back to Moab. Would you recommend?
I would recommend. Maybe if you can make it down there, not during early July, so you can escape the heat, probably is the most optimal. Anytime around that is probably more optimal to visit. But even though we had very hot couple of days there, we still had a great time. So anytime you can make it down, I recommend it.
Yeah, make your way to Moab. Don't be a schmuck. Go to Moab.
Mm-hmm.
That's my Moab.
Now make moment. It rhyme.
Don't be a Loab. Go to Moab.
How clever.
If you're feeling Loab, make your way to Moab.
Now that's clever.
Now if you need to show up, make your way to Moab.
Come to Moab. We're expecting you to show up. There you go.
Hey, there it is. Hey. All right, and scene. Mm-hmm. That brings us all the way to what I am so excited about this week, Jeremy.
Yes.
It's our dark history of the week.
Now, you've texted me about this as you were researching, and it may be the craziest story in your, and you regard it as basically the craziest story that you've researched. Is that correct?
I'd say this is one of the most insane stories I've ever heard, and I can't believe there's not a movie about it.
Well, maybe you can make it a thing. Who
yeah,
knows?
I'll call some of my people at Paramount and see what we can do.
He has people at Paramount. He's not lying.
I actually do have people at Paramount.
So this is
I'm important.
So treat this listener, treat this as a movie pitch. You might see it in theaters because it'll release hopefully after the vaccine is out. So this is what we're aiming for. This is why Jacob has it ready for you to go.
Yes, we have the vaccine.
Mm-hmm. So, well, I'm very curious. Go ahead.
For this week's dark history, we are going to take a dip into the cool waters of a real life Fargo season four character, and that seems like a good place to already take a sidebar.
Yeah, so it's someone with not a lot of depth, very not interesting, not well explained.
Let me just say, we say this every week, but because about like that week's episode, this week's episode of Fargo was horrendous.
Maybe I don't know, like we watched it together, of course, but it was bad.
But
I don't know. I'm not making as big of a deal out of it.
I have never in my life seen a show that could be so good go that far down the rabbit hole into the realms of terribleness.
I mean, I thought it was going to be kind of cool. And then it just didn't do it. It didn't execute.
No, you know what was kind of cool? When Euphoria had flashes of black and white, that was cool. When Watchmen successfully pulled off a backstory in black and white, that was cool. This was not cool.
Well, it has a little bit of time to recover. You can't make any judgments about the season yet. We're only nine episodes in, baby. Mm-hmm.
Oh, God. Well, anyway, back to this dark history for the week. After compiling notes from AP News, Murderpedia, the law school at University of Michigan, and many local articles, I present to you the insane story of Utah psychiatric doctor Robert Allen Weitzel, also known as the real-life Oneonta from Fargo.
Also known between the two of us now. Oneonta.
Oh,
it's
yeah,
not her name. Areta. I don't even know.
Her name's Areta?
Orietta. Something like that.
So you're telling me it's not Oneonta?
It can be Oneonta. I think it's
better. And I've been calling her Oneonta for 9 weeks.
I mean, we know Oneonta. And it just seems correct to name
I,
that.
I think I thought that was her name.
No, it's like something with an O-R. But regardless, for those who haven't watched the season, that means that this person is outright insane. So I'm very much looking forward to what you got for us, Jacob.
Yeah. So let me give you what I know about Robert Weitzel. He was born in California and was studying to become a doctor of psychiatric medicine at the University of California, San Diego. He began studying there in the late 80s and finished his residency, in 1993.
Hmm. So he's a learned man.
Yes, well, he's a doctor. He's a doctor.
Sounds pretty standard thus far.
Yes, but I want to emphasize that this guy has a lot of red flags all around, the first of which came during his residency at UC San Diego.
Hmm.
That was in 1990. He began to treat a 32-year-old woman complaining of depression and marital problems. So that was 1990.
Yeah.
By 1992, she had divorced her husband and entered an intimate relationship with Robert Weitzel.
See, that's her choice, and that's Robert's decision. Nothing wrong here. Nothing wrong here whatsoever.
Well, besides the fact that, she was his patient and that she came in with depression and marital problems, that doesn't raise a flag with you?
These things happen all the time.
They don't. That's the point of doctors.
It's a red flag. It's a red flag.
Well, it was that year, 1992, that Weitzel was also issued his Utah practicing license, and he moved to Utah in 1993.
Ah, the coveted Utah practicing license.
Yes, the one that all the doctors have.
It allows you to practice.
The woman who was a former patient, the one we just talked about at UC San Diego, became pregnant and had an abortion in 1994, and Weitzel cut ties with her the same year. Okay, so besides raising big ethical issues in like patient-doctor relationships, it's just a generally shitty thing to do to a person.
To up and leave, especially after that happens, gives me kind of flashbacks of Bob from last week, our Bob, whatever his name was that I covered. He just up and left. Who'd just want to leave?
Bob Spangler.
He'd want to leave situation. Selfishly want to leave something that he doesn't want to be a part of.
Well, only after murdering everyone in the situation.
Well, that's a small part of it. Don't focus on just that.
Okay. So the California Board of Medicine opened an investigation into the case about that doctor-patient thing, and Weitzel ended up surrendering his license in 1997 rather than face the charges against him. So these are the charges I'm going to read to you.
Okay.
He methodically manipulated a patient and her treatment to use her as an object to gratify his own emotional and sexual needs.
Ooh.
Yeah, that's no good.
Sounds dark and sinister.
Yeah. So now we're in 1994. He's practicing in Utah, and he ends up joining the Davis Hospital and Medical Center in Layton, Utah, in September of 1995.
So he's jumping around. He's still getting work.
Yeah, he's getting work. But the red flag alert will continue right here. The board in Utah received an anonymous complaint almost immediately in October of 1995. So he started in September. Now we're in October.
Yeah.
That Weitzel was obtaining Demerol and morphine under his patients' names for his own personal use.
Now, I don't want to give many spoilers away, but this is the most Fargo-y thing I've learned about this man thus far.
Oh, it gets way more Fargo-y, but
that is very much like something that happens in the course of the season. You're not going to watch it. We shat on it. We can spoil it. You don't need to watch it. You don't need to watch it.
Right. So Weitzel is literally taking the names of his patients, writing prescriptions for morphine, and then going to the pharmacy to fill them up himself. and use those drugs like he's a druggie.
Oh my lord.
He's an addict. That's a better term.
Yeah, he's an addict. But what's he doing with all that stuff?
Right. And the fact that he's like a prescriber, that should never have happened.
Right. No, exactly.
And in that vein, the Recovery Assistance Program admitted that they did not handle the case well because 3 months later, five of Weitzel's elderly patients died within a 15-day period of each other.
It just happened to be like that. That's nothing to be concerned about. I like how they admitted that they didn't handle the case well. Like, yeah, we saw some irregularities.
It's like a quiet, we fucked up.
Right. Very quiet, very quiet. No one needs to know.
Right. So let's get into these patients real quick.
Sure.
The first to die was 91-year-old Ellen Anderson, a widow who died one day after being admitted to Weitzel's care from a 20-milligram dose of morphine.
One day after being admitted to his care?
Yeah, Weitzel had given her the morphine for what he called osteoporosis pain, and he reported signs of pneumonia that didn't exist.
Right.
The next death was also a widow, 93-year-old Judith Larson, who came in with terminal intestinal bleeding but was prescribed 138 milligrams of morphine, which she had on the last day of her life.
That has to be so much. I'm not too sure how, about like dosage and stuff, but you told me that the last one was 20 milligrams.
Yes.
She was given 138.
Yes.
That has to be, that could kill you probably more than like five times over.
No doubt about it.
93 years old. Jeez.
I know. But next was Mary R. Crane, a 72-year-old woman suffering from depression and psychosis who was prescribed, wait for it, Jeremy.
Wow.
Morphine.
Oh my goodness, he used morphine?
Morphine by Weitzel, and she died 4 days after Judith Larson.
It sounds like this guy is like a really bad school nurse who only prescribes ice, but instead of ice, you know, it's morphine.
Yeah, he really goes right for it. I mean, what are we doing here? This is just the way to go.
It's the panacea, morphine.
The panacea.
It's right here. We've invented it. Morphine.
Morphine. Morphine. It feels good.
It feels good until it doesn't.
We can't do an ad for morphine.
You didn't hear that from me.
After other psychosis drugs and morphine, the next one, 90-year-old Lydia Smith died the day after Mary Crane under Weitzel's charge.
So these people are just dying, like, they're like falling like flies under this guy.
I mean, I don't want to laugh about it, and it's horrible and sad, but yes, yeah. Like, someone didn't realize that this was happening.
Like, this guy is literally murdering people day after day.
Between the last two, it was 4 days, and between this past one and the one we just talked about, Lydia Smith, is one day.
Yeah, it's a day. Man, murderer in their midst.
Right. So finally, this is the last of the five. 85-year-old Ennis Aldridge, a stroke patient and man who loaded gravel for a living, died after...
That's a great way to be described.
Yeah. That was the way they actually described him in the article.
That's depressing, but go on.
Well, he died after receiving 20 milligrams of morphine every hour until his death by Weitzel.
20, that's like when you know, like, guy, he must have known that this guy was killing him. 20 milligrams hour after hour.
Yeah, it's really Oneonta vibes.
It's awful. Yeah.
But let me again emphasize that all of these deaths took place between late December 1995 and early January 1996.
So this is just quite a short time span for all this.
15 days, yes.
15 days. Wow.
So with all these deaths in such a short span, none of which required morphine doses, by the way, how was Weitzel not arrested immediately? That was my first question.
Wait, yeah, exactly. What are they doing?
Well, the hospital opened an internal investigation later in 1996, and by 1997, Robert Weitzel had moved to the Matagorda County Hospital in Texas, despite his California license surrender and ongoing investigation in Utah.
So he's just trying to make a living hopping from place to place in the country because I guess it's a viable thing for him to do.
Yes, he's now in Texas.
Yeah, he's just hopping around.
He's living his John Wayne fantasy.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, when he began in Texas, he had no DEA registration. By the way, something that if you can prescribe drugs, you have to have. But the hospital allowed him to use their DEA registration number to prescribe medication without actually checking in with the DEA in California or Utah.
This is like the perfect storm of like oversights for him to remain active like this and not be caught.
Right.
He's just lucky.
Right. And you know, I told you there's a lot of red flags with Weitzel. Mm-hmm. Here's the next one. In October of 1998, Weitzel was reprimanded for lying on his Texas medical license renewal form.
Well, a little lie, you know. You're trying to portray the best version of yourself. It makes sense.
Well, you could portray the best version of yourself without lying.
Oh, that's a good piece of advice.
I better contact your employers.
There's none to contact.
Well, anyway, Weitzel continued working after being charged. Oh, I skipped one, didn't I? Oh, no. So he continued.
You don't
working.
Know this all by heart?
Well, I kind of know this. I know this story. I understand what happened in order. It took a long time to piece together, but my specific points that I've written down here. Continued working after being charged by Utah's DOPPEL. DOPPEL, by the way, is the licensing organization, if you don't know what that is.
Of course.
But he was charged by Utah's DOPPEL with failing to keep required records regarding disposition of controlled substances, prescribing controlled substances in excess of necessary amounts, and demonstrating incompetence and negligence in the practice of medicine.
5 stars.
But what I'm saying is he continued working after being charged with all of that in Utah.
That's crazy.
And now here's another crazy twist.
Yeah, go ahead.
He also continued working at that Texas hospital after 86-year-old Laura Ware died under his care from...
No.
What do you think it was?
She tripped and fell.
That's right. It was morphine. It was a morphine overdose. Another one now in Texas.
Let's make it like five or six. How
That's
many people
six.
Is he? Six. My God.
Yes. So let me pause and say that this is the most absurd and ridiculous fucking case I have ever looked into. And I really do encourage you to look more into the insanity that is Robert Allen Weitzel, because I can't cover everything. And he is like so fucked up.
So what you're saying is that there's got to be like some like investigative stuff done on him.
Yeah. Like- I mean, there's some other stuff like that I haven't even talked about, like that he did drugs with his brother who later died of an overdose. He had been accused of stalking former girlfriends. Like assaulted people. He had yelled at nurses before. Like, this guy was crazy.
Yeah, no, it's all sorts of fucked up. And it's interesting, like you didn't see any sort of like documentary on it or anything like that.
No, there's nothing out there like that. It's just
That's
articles
crazy. I feel like there got to be a movie of this. There's got to be a movie of this.
Right. But that brings us to 1999, where his past finally catches up to him. September 20th, 1999, Robert Weitzel is arrested by authorities in Texas on a warrant issued in Utah and charged with 5 counts of first-degree murder.
Well, there you go. Took
murder.
Long enough. Took long enough.
There's been a murder.
There's been a murders.
Voodoo Mama Juju.
Excuse me?
Voodoo Mama Juju.
Oh, I was going to say, what did you just call me?
Voodoo Mama Juju.
Oh, thank you.
From The Office, come on. The murder episode.
Oh, right.
We just watched this.
We didn't just watch it. It's been at least a few days.
Oh, my God.
Mm-hmm.
that was an iconic one. But anyway, 2 days after he's arrested for 5 counts of first-degree murder, on September 22nd, 1999, federal prosecutors in Utah unsealed an indictment charging him with 22 counts of obtaining controlled substances by deception.
That's a lot of counts.
But Weitzel went on trial in June of 2000, with medical experts testifying that patients' bodies contained excessive amounts of morphine and that Weitzel was engaging in a pattern of euthanasia.
Euthanasia. What? These are murders.
Euthanasia. I mean, he's charged with murder, but euthanasia is the type of murder that he's committing.
I don't know. I feel like sometimes that implies, like, you know, like graceful, like peaceful, like taking them out of their misery. He's stripping their lives short, in my mind.
Well, what is interesting about this case is that this case was one of the big things that sparked the national debate about euthanasia and like doctor patient care type things.
Yeah, it can quickly become kind of political. I can definitely see that.
Yeah, so it is interesting. I'm telling you once again, like, look up about Robert Weitzel. He is crazy. Mm-hmm. But on July 10th 2000, a jury convicted Weitzel of 2 counts of felony manslaughter and 3 counts of misdemeanor negligent homicide, and he was sentenced 1 to 15 years in prison.
Oh, that's quite a span of years, 1 to 15. They also dropped all like the 5 counts of first degree murder, so those didn't stick.
Right. I mean, yeah, you know, you kill 6 people and you get 1 to 15 years.
That's not bad at all. You just got to use morphine. I guess that's what the trick is.
Well, it turns out he wouldn't even get 1 year because we're in January of 2001. Dr. Perry Fine, a respected doctor, disclosed that he had told the prosecution he did not believe Weitzel had engaged in any criminal conduct, but he had never testified in the case.
So it should just be thrown out. He never testified.
That's exactly what they said. Based on this, Robert Weitzel was granted a new trial, and in August 2001, Weitzel pled guilty to 2 counts of federal prescription fraud for writing those prescriptions for personal use, and was sentenced to 1 year and 1 day in prison. Ugh. But he actually went on trial a second time again in November of 2002 for the manslaughter and negligent homicide charges.
Oh my God, so like, he's sort of like skirting under the radar with the sentencing. He's not getting his punishment.
At this point, we're on his third trial,
right?
Essentially.
Now, I don't know if you know this. Can he stay out of prison while all this is happening?
So he was incarcerated during that first term, which was 2000 to 2001.
Okay.
That was July 2000 to January of 2001. He was in prison.
It's not even like then, a year.
Right. Then he wasn't incarcerated while he waited for his next trial. And then after that trial, he was incarcerated until his third trial, which is the one we're up to now.
Ooh. This guy so deserves to just rot in prison.
I know. Under cross-examination, Dr. Michael Crookston... I mean, he has the word crook literally in his name.
This is Dr. Michael Crookston.
Yeah, I'm Dr. Michael Crookston. What about it? What's it do ya?
This is quite a legal defense.
Yes. Well, he testified that there is no magic formula that solves every problem for patients, and not all doctors agree on what and how much medication a patient needs. And so based on that, on November 22nd, 2002, Robert Weitzel was acquitted by a jury and became a free man once again.
That's just not enough to convince me to acquit someone.
he just made it out.
It's just like, you know, magic formula. There's no magic formula. He tried and tried and tried and failed in regards to the care of these patients, quote unquote, tried.
What I didn't write about in this that like, I guess I should mention, although it does seem to me like to be a little besides the point, is other doctors like testified defending him, saying like there was no way he could have known, but like also he should have known, like it's his patients, and also he shouldn't have been using patient medication in the first place, which definitely was the thing that caused him to do this. Like one of the patients I read, like it was, he got a page at 3 a.m. back when pagers were a thing. He got like a page at 3 a.m. about like that one of the patients needed more morphine, and so, or like needed his assistance, and instead of going in to assist them, he just said, give him more morphine.
See, that's sort of where I like just deviate from however these people are thinking to acquit this guy. I think essentially like saying like, you know, there's no magic formula to care for patients. I think after you kill one person, probably with a morphine overdose, is when you should start to rethink how you treat your patients.
Right. That's, I mean, that's exactly what I think.
So I don't know what they were thinking, but I guess this guy, so he's acquitted.
Right. He's acquitted. So Robert Weitzel, who had engaged in sexual behavior with patients, stalked former girlfriends, intimidated nurses, assaulted people, lied on licensing renewal forms, used patient names to get morphine for personal use, and killed 6 people, he wasn't done yet.
I was going to say, like, he, that, and like, he was scot-free, but like, so what is he, what's going on? What's happening with him?
Well, he created a webpage, WeitzelCharts.com, to put up extensive hospital and nursing home records of his patients, including psychiatric histories, comments by families, and medication charts.
That just sounds illegal. It just doesn't sound like something you can do.
Well, I'll explain why it wasn't illegal when I talk about what he said about it. So this is a Robert Weitzel quote.
Yeah.
They're part of the public record of my trial, and they clear me. No doctor who reads them could conclude I'd committed any crime. Still, I mean, it wasn't illegal because it was on the public record from his case, but it's so unethical.
Well, it's so unethical, and it certainly is one of those things people ask, what are some things that are legal but really feel illegal? I think this might be on the top of the list. Like, that's so feels illegal. It's not even...
I know.
It really feels like it violates a bunch of codes.
Oh, absolutely. I agree completely.
Not just ethical codes, other shit.
Right, but he still, unbelievably, after all of this, had a license to practice medicine in Texas.
A lawless land.
But after all the trials and incarceration, Robert Weitzel decided to live in Salt Lake City, Utah.
Oh, so he's moving back. He's going back to his roots. He's going to Utah.
Yes, he calls himself Robert Weitzel, MD, and his LinkedIn description is medicine person at Robert Allen Weitzel. So he still practices as a psychologist without a medical license, seemingly without remorse for all of his past actions.
So he has a LinkedIn. Let me just have you re-emphasize that for me for a sec. This guy still has a LinkedIn.
Yes, I found him on LinkedIn. And what I, if this is okay with you, it's going to be a little longer, but I really, really want to read his LinkedIn bio to you, so you can hear what he's up to today and get a sense of who this man is.
All right, go ahead. I'm very wary.
Okay, you ready?
Yes.
All right, here we go. Although medications have their uses, it seems far too many psychiatrists have no knowledge or training in post-trauma psychopathology, self-psychology, narcissism theory, or even psychotherapy, and throw drugs at every symptom. That's the beginning.
He's off to a strong start.
He's saying other people throw drugs at every symptom.
I think there are multiple lines where you could just say hypocrite. This guy's probably a narcissist as well. It sounds like it. So
he kind of reminds me of Donald Trump.
What would you make him do that?
People, so this is more quotes from his LinkedIn bio.
Yes.
People are more than their neurotransmitters, and trauma is not well treated by the drugs that pharmaceutical companies are pushing. Although board certified in general psychiatry, I have left medical practice and now work with plant medicine, guiding clients to the state of beyond with entheogens, which are psychedelics.
Oh, no.
We have established the Beyond Institute under the auspices of the Native American Church, in parentheses now, thus legal. Mm-hmm. So that's how he got away with using psychedelics in treatment, is he filed them under the Native American Church, which makes them legal.
Oh, my God.
Continuing the quote, while using protocols similar to those developed by MAPS, the multidisciplinary... Oh, my God. What happened? The Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies. And then he puts in parentheses, the safer and more efficacious.
This man is a total nutcase.
Mm-hmm. he continues, I'm not done. He continues and says, I enjoy working with people who want a positive psychology-centered wellness program and those interested in Buddhist principles of exploring the most basic problems of human living to find liberation. I am a strong advocate of the use of psychedelics as potent and curative medicines, using methods first discovered by indigenous peoples and now under investigation by MAPS and major medical institutions.
So this guy likes, basically, he's a huge DMT guy, is what I'm getting at.
You know, Jeremy, DMT, it's what you want to be tripping on. It's where you find the aliens, and we cure diseases.
Yes. This guy, I can imagine, is Alex Jones's friend. He's a future guest of the Joe Rogan podcast.
We should check. Has he been a guest on it? We'll look that up after this.
Yeah, I don't know, but I think that maybe if Joe Rogan has heard about this guy, he would so invite him on that show. And
oh, he would. He loves having murderers, rapists, and other horrible people on the show.
You mean people who are free of free thought, Jacob? Is that's what you mean?
Nope, it's not. Mm-hmm. And now let me finish off his LinkedIn bio. Robert Weisel's, that is. I was radicalized by my experience of being attacked in 1999 by medically ignorant prosecutors who mischaracterized standard end-of-life care as euthanasia. I was exonerated, but the experience led to rethinking the medical paradigm and our country's authoritarian and punitive legal stance, which perpetuates a war on ourselves that serves only the police, lawyers, regulatory bureaucrats, drug lords, and the prison industry.
I would not want to get a beer with this guy.
I mean, he has a lot of issues.
It's a lot. It's very problematic that all that's on LinkedIn.
That's all on his LinkedIn bio. That's the first thing you read if you go on his LinkedIn.
That he addresses those things so blatantly is also another like big red flag for me just as a person. I mean, of course, yeah. The red flag is that he did all this in his life. But if he can go on basically as a scot-free guy and not want to sweep any of this under the rug, I think something is just so wrong with that.
There's something seriously wrong here.
Like he feels... He probably, just thinking about this, the way it's written, he probably is a narcissist. He probably feels no remorse for anything that he's done in his life. And he gets the practice along those lines. It's really fucked up.
It's really fucked up.
And from what you've told me, there's like barely anything on this guy. I think maybe, yeah, hopefully he gets exposed from this. And
yeah,
other
I mean, I did a lot of research. Like, I was really trying, because there were so many things that just weren't like the full story. And like every time I like searched his name up again and found different sites to go on and different articles and different things, I found out like a new snippet about him that was just even more crazy than the last thing I had read. So in piecing all of that together, I hope I have delivered you some type of
good
rendering of what happened here, because that is the insane story of Robert Allen Weitzel.
Ooh, and you can get treated by him. Go to Utah, go to Salt Lake City. We could have visited.
Yeah, I looked it up. He still has his practice listed online. You can go be treated by this psychopath who killed six people. So that's available as an option.
If you're into dark tourism, you might just want to do that just to try it out.
Well, yes. There you have it. That was Robert Allen Weitzel.
Jeez. Well, on to bigger and better things, Jacob.
Yes, Jeremy, it's time for our fan question of the week. What you got for us, Jeremy?
Oh, I had so many questions. Yeah. I could have chosen from this week.
Do you need a 5-minute break?
I don't need a 5-minute break. That's the fan question. Do I need a 5-minute? Nope, just kidding. We don't need a 5-minute break. Because I have it right here.
Let me think about how many ways you can stall pulling up the inbox, looking through the inbox, finding a question that's reasonable. I know there's thousands of crazy questions we get, and we thank you, by the way, for sending those crazy questions to roadboyspodcast@gmail.com, and of course for DMing them to us on our social medias, which you can find Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at roadboyspodcast.
Yes, I found
I tried to give you a bit more time there.
I found a good one.
What you got?
So this one comes all the way from the great city of New York. The city's so nice they named it twice, New York City.
Manhattan.
And the name of this man is Giuliani Hairstylist. That's his username.
Oh, Giuliani Hairstylist. He sounds great. Probably works with a lot of dyes.
Yes, with a lot of dyes. He asked, does absolute power corrupt absolutely?
Okay, well, I don't really understand the question.
Does absolute power corrupt, like, all the time?
What do we define as absolute power?
Like, given a position of great power and the ability to, like, do stuff on your own, make your own choices, without too many checks on that power, does it corrupt a good bit of the time? Does it corrupt the person a good bit? Does absolute power corrupt absolutely? That's what it means.
Oh, no. I don't know if I can answer that because I still don't quite understand the definition. But I'll say that everything corrupts everybody. Mm-hmm. The moment someone says something to you, you're corrupted. Boom. That's it. See you. Bye. Finished.
It's the lamestream media, Jacob. That's corrupting the youth today.
No, it's not the media that's corrupting the youth. What is corrupting the youth is people who lie about losing an election to try and salvage their own thing and overthrow a democratic principle that has been institutionalized for almost 300 years.
I think that maybe also having this is not aimed at anyone in particular, having the ability to work directly under a crazy ass president also could get to your head a lot and ruin whatever career you had prior. And even if it was a good career, it got to your head that you were working under the president. And so, yes, to Giuliani Hairstylist, I think that potentially absolute power can corrupt absolutely. So the thing is, though, the question asks if it always corrupts people. That's the absolute part.
I just truly don't understand the question.
How can you not understand the question, Jacob?
I'm sorry. I don't understand it.
Does it always corrupt you? Make you a bad person? And I don't think it does necessarily.
But I don't understand absolute power, like what that actually would mean. But regardless, there's the answer.
Mm-hmm.
There we have it.
It can. but it doesn't always. That's my bit. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah. Great. Well, next week we'll be. Where the hell will we be? Oh, we'll still be in Utah next week.
Well, we won't have moved too far from Moab. We'll be looking at some of the national parks in the area.
Yeah, that should be really exciting, actually. I'm very excited for that. Make sure you check in with our socials again this week, because we're going to be posting photos from Moab, from the surrounding area. It'll be really cool.
Yes, and beyond that, we're hitting some amazing areas next week, so you're going to want to tune in as well to episode 11. That'll be coming at you.
Yeah, actually, I think, by the way, my favorite photo from our trip was taken at our next episode's location.
Ooh, so you're going to have to tune in to hear about that.
Absolutely.
So, in the meantime, keep trucking on. And keep a good eye over your crop yield.
And happy Thanksgiving.
Happy Thanksgiving.
Have a nice Thanksgiving. Make mm-hmm. sure you don't see anybody.
Yes. don't travel for Jacob's birthday. It's another big one.
Yes, please. My birthday is so important. I understand that. And I understand my hordes of fans will be very disappointed. But I am telling you, please do not travel. Mm-hmm. Stay safe.
You heard it from the man himself.
Stay online.
Like a good neighbor.
Oh!
Yes.
Now remember, don't travel, stay safe, and stay online.
Road Boys, starring Jacob Velotti and Jeremy Shapiro as themselves. Produced by Jacob Velotti and Jeremy Shapiro. Directed by Jacob Velotti and Jeremy Shapiro. And created by Jacob Velotti and Jeremy Shapiro. Special thanks to Vlad Glashenko for recording the intro and outro music royalty-free. And Tina Perkins, that's me, for recording promotional content. To learn more, follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Road Boys Podcast.